This is Morgan Michael, welcoming you to Kindsight 101, the podcast, where you'll hear from world-renowned educational leaders about the mobilizing power of kindness, together by challenging our assumptions and venturing beyond the status quo in education. We can make a big impact, one small act at a time.
We need to learn from each other. We need to tap into this community because this is such an amazing time. We connect with people over the world, but if you cannot connect with your own school, it doesn't matter.
George Koros is a leading educator in the area of innovative leadership, teaching, and learning. He has worked with all levels of the school system, from K-12 as a teacher, technology facilitator, and school and district administrator. He is the author of the book, The Innovator's Mindset, and writes a super popular blog entitled The Principle of Change, has done a TED Talk, hosts his own podcast, and is a well-respected speaker. He is also the creator of ConnectedPrinciples.com and a contributor to Edutopia.com. You can connect with him on Twitter, Instagram, Facebook, and other social media by typing at G. Koros or by searching his name. In this episode, we talk about the power of encouraging our learners and educators to be problem finders, what it takes to develop an innovator's mindset, and the distinction between what it means to engage versus empower our students. We dig deep into meaningful ways to motivate our school community to tap into their passions and interests, and talk about overcoming the constraints associated with many schools right now. He highlights the two important questions that he asked any student who found themselves in the principal's office with him, and shows us how to build student agency over their learning and behavior. You won't want to miss this important conversation.
First of all, I would like to thank you, George Koros, for being here. You're an innovative educator and educational leader across the world, and I'm so appreciative to have you on the show today.
Hey, thanks for having me. I would say that I don't know if I'm a leader in those areas, but I'm really passionate about them and try to connect and learn from as many people as possible. So it's something I really appreciate.
Well, I would say that a lot of people are inspired by you, and certainly your body of work has created a sense of trust. So I think that's sort of the underpinning of what a good leader is, for sure. I'd like to delve into this concept of the innovator's mindset. You need to make the positives so loud that the negatives are almost impossible to hear. This is something that you said in 2017 at a keynote. And when it comes to education, we really can't please everyone. And we have to know when to elevate the positive and sort of drown out the negatives. How does that philosophy kind of tie into this concept of the innovator's mindset? What is it? And why is it so important now more than ever to sort of develop this?
It's actually really interesting because it's by far one of the most shared quotes of anything that I've written, anything that I've said, and it's easily one of the most debated quotes as well. And I think that when you don't hear it in the context of the story, and it does, you know, tend to get people to, you know, push back quite a bit, and rightfully so. And the idea behind it is that it's not to ignore negative things that might be happening in your school or your district or your classroom. It's not to ignore conflict. In fact, if anyone knows of my work and knows of what I do, I actually really appreciate critical challenge. I think it's really important. It's really focusing on the people that are looking to find solutions, not find a problem with every solution, if that makes sense to you.
It does. Because
I'm sure that, you know, every person that's listening to this right now can literally think of someone and visualize them in their head of someone that no matter what you say, it's wrong. And they're not necessarily doing it to help you move forward. They're actually doing it to help you, to hold you back. And so I think that when you're talking about the innovator's mindset, one of the concepts I talk about that was kind of shed light on was Ewan McIntosh. He talked about the notion of problem finders and problem solvers, not one or the other. And so we want people to actually look at things that, you know, are happening in our world, or society, within our, you know, communities, and not just give problems to kids that they don't really care about finding a solution to, but actually lead our kids to find those problems to actually create something much more powerful. And I think that's why it's so crucial, is that when you're doing work that is challenging, but you know you're doing it for the right reasons. I think that it's okay to have critical challenge, but I think it's also important to know when to shut out the voices that can actually come externally or internally. I know I have self-doubt all the time with stuff that I'm doing, and shut those things out and to forge ahead, as long as you have your purpose of why you're doing it in the first place and that it's, you know, for a good reason.
I think that's so important, and I appreciate you even sharing the vulnerability that you have, because I think sometimes there's a perception that when one is doing very well, as you are, that perhaps you might not feel that way. But I think whenever we are trying something new as an educator or as a leader, it's accompanied by that feeling of trepidation or that feeling that we're risking something. And ultimately, would you say that when you have that feeling, you kind of lean into it? Would you say it's a positive thing? Is that a signal for you that you're maybe headed in the right direction when you feel that way?
I don't know if I would say that. I don't know if it shows that I'm going in the right direction. I just know, I think one of the things that does make me really vulnerable is how much I actually blog. Like, I've really committed to trying to blog 3 times a week. And I've done that for probably the last 9 years. Mm-hmm. And, you know, a lot of people quote me, you know, in the education community, and and I'm always honored by it. But if you actually look at how much I've written and actually how much has actually stuck with people, it's like such a small percentage. And I think for me, the reason why stuff sticks is because I write so much stuff, and eventually you're going to find that right space. And so I've really learned to just, you know, keep creating and kind of, you know, leaning into just the process. And I think that's really important for me, is not really worry about, ooh, is someone going to like this? Is this going to resonate or anything like that? I have a purpose of, you know, what I write and, you know, sharing my thoughts, to really write for myself. And, you know, if something sticks, that's awesome. And it tells me something, but I don't necessarily, you know, write so that I get a ton of retweets and get it shared all over. I write because it helps me think, it helps me process. And I think that sharing the pathway of our learning is really powerful. And I think it's a really good thing that we model for the teachers we serve, the administrators we serve, and more importantly, obviously the students we serve. Because we are so product focused in so many areas, not only in education but outside. But I think the process is where a lot of the beauty happens, and you kind of learn. I know that I used to be terrified to press publish, but I was so worried about what other people would think, as opposed to, you know, kind of switching gears and really saying, okay, this is not to be a thought leader. This is just me to share my process. And I think that really lifted a lot of, constraints off myself.
Sure. And I think, you know, I've talked to Seth Godin directly about that too. And I think that's so similar to his message as well, as he says, you know, you may not have a home run hitter every time in your blog, and that really shouldn't even be your goal, but that it is kind of this reflective process that allows you to sort of really simplify and clarify your thoughts. So on that sort of topic, what do you, I think about how important it is for educators to take risks and to really delve into who they are, what drives them, their big, you know, Simon Sinek why. And mm-hmm. How do you see sort of the digital footprint being part of that in terms of whether it's blogging or the way that you engage in, you know, Twitter, as an educator, but also as a leader? How does that sort of process help someone to get clear on who they are, and why is it so important?
Well, the thing is, like, I'm a pretty big advocate of people, you know, having a digital footprint, especially in a time where, you know, people are getting Googled, not only professionally, but personally. And you know, I'd rather that when someone Googles me, they find my thoughts, not what someone else thinks about me, or, you know, take something out of context. But for me, I've always told people, don't really focus on branding yourself. I'm not a big fan of the term branding. I struggle with it quite a bit. But just share your learning online, and your footprint will take care of itself. I think That's part of the process. And actually, you know, tying back to Seth Godin, he has a quote, and I'm just going to paraphrase it because there's no way I'm going to say it. But he basically says, you know, the world is on candid camera right now, and the best thing you can do is inundate the web with good stuff. Mm-hmm. And it's something that I've tried to do. And even one of the things that I really am proud of, and I know it's going to sound weird, is that I do share some personal things. I'm a person that speaks about education. I'm not an educator that just happens to be a person. Mm-hmm. And I think that is where a lot of people get so stuck. They're all about their brand and, you know, painting a certain picture. But one of the things I tweet about that I'm actually most known for is I tweet every Friday. I tweet a question to people, you know, and it's something related to something that, you know, happens to teachers, you know, and it's called Friday Gift Day.
Yeah.
And we'll just respond back in gift form. And it's meant to be funny, and it's meant to, like, you know, just kind of people to share something interesting about themselves or kind of something that they're going through. And actually, it was pretty funny because I was speaking at a conference. I was a keynote there and really honored to be there. And someone came up to me and said, "Hey, are you the Friday Gift Day guy?" And I was That's what I'm known for. And I was like, kind of taken aback at first, like, really? Like, I've done all this work and that's what you know me for? And then I really thought about it. And I really thought about that process. And I thought, you know, if I tweet one thing a week and a bunch of people around the world share something that makes a bunch of other people around the world smile, I could live with being known for that. And I think now when I thought about it really deep, I was like, it's actually part of leadership, right? It's part of building community. It's part of connecting other people. Cause all I do is ask the question and everyone else provides the hilarious material. And I think it's a really cool process, but it's just, I was actually having like a really horrible day and it just happened to be a Friday. And I'm like, I need a laugh. And here's a way I'm going to get a laugh from other people. And so I just threw out a question. And I was like, this is really cool. And so I just started doing it. And people, like, if I tweet that a little bit later than usual, people are like, "Hey, when are you doing the Friday day?" Like, it's like people are to see other people's answers. I think it's a really cool thing.
So I'm so glad you brought that up because, I mean, I've read your book a couple of times and I read it again just to sort of have some of those ideas fresh in my head. And there's a part in your book where you talk about the fact that relationships are the key to leadership and to effective teaching. And so I'm so glad that you brought that up with that Friday gift because I've definitely seen it. I've definitely partook myself. And the relationships are everything and this fun and connection. And you were actually inspired by the movie Billy Madison, which to me sort of speaks to the fact that you love infusing the sort of fun aspect of education into what you do. You sing songs online. Like, you just, I love that. I think it's such a key part of what makes you who you are. But also as an educator, often I feel like I'm very, I can be very certainty oriented and I can get really caught in the weeds, and I know I'm not the only one. So seeing that example is so inspiring. And so why do you think that developing that connection through that fun and authentic manner is so integral to an effective sort of educational system?
Well, I think when we talk about innovation and leadership, I think it's really crucial because you want to know that if you're going to try something that is maybe a little bit different, you're going to try something that is, you know, maybe not going to make other people feel comfortable because it's new, right? Not because it's bad, because no one intentionally goes and does bad work, you know, but it's something that, you know, people are not comfortable with. I think that it's so crucial that you know your leader has your back, that you know your leader supports you. And I think this is so true in the classroom as well, that, you know, students are often asked to take risks, but they're taking risks for people that they don't necessarily feel comfortable with, and that what's going to happen if they screw up. And I wrote, and I'm sure you read that part. I talked about, you know, the importance of failure as a process, not as a product, because I actually really despise when people talk about how important it is to teach kids to fail. We don't want kids to fail. We want kids to try new things. And along the way, their failure is part of the process, but it's the getting back up. But I think a lot of kids and a lot of teachers, are worried they won't get back up because they don't have the connection with, you know, their teacher or with their administrator, that they will not only not be able to get back up, they will actually be pushed down for doing something different. And I think that when you build those relationships and you build that culture of trust, and I'm a really big fan of Stephen Covey's work, obviously you can kind of see quotations and paraphrase thoughts from him in my blog and obviously in my book as well, that if you don't have trust, you're not going to get people to try different things. You're not going to get people to, you know, push themselves to, they're going to do, you know, basically the bare minimum, not go above and beyond because they're too scared if something were to go wrong. And if they do go above and beyond and there is no relationship, it's in spite of you. It's not because of you. That's for sure.
Yeah. And I think that's such an important point. This idea that not only are we creating an environment to foster that risk taking and kind of going out on a limb and seeing maybe this may or may not work, but then also I think a lot of it comes from this sense of empathy too, that we know what it feels like to take risks as educators, or perhaps we should try. And I think back to that blog idea, there is this sort of element of risk when we publish our material in such a public way, right? And so being able to step into their shoes gives us a sense of what it's like to actually be a student, right? And I know that you talk a lot about empathy. One of the questions that really popped out at me too was this idea of, would I want to be a learner in my own class? And that stuck with me, you know, throughout the reading of your book. It stuck with me as I was planning lessons, as I was talking to my students. And I thought, yeah, that's such an important question. It's also really huge when we're thinking about Pro-D too, right? Because sometimes we forget what it's like to sit and listen for an entire day. And sometimes that's what Pro-D looks like. And so in terms of that idea of, would I want to be a learner in my own class, how is it that educators can sort of tap into the passion and the personal interests in order of students or of even teachers for that matter to make that learning environment really come alive? Like, how do we do that?
Well, I think what's really important in the question is the empathy, because a lot of people, when I say that, they're like, yeah, I would love to be in my class. I'm like, I don't think you're understanding the question. Why we ask you the question is so that you can go from the viewpoint of your students, understand who they are, what they appreciate. And as you said, you know, what their passions, what their talents, what their strengths are. And is this something that, you know, is bringing out the best in them? Like, so, and I know this is like a weird example because people, you know, this is something that's lauded all over the world. You know, people talk about maker spaces and like doing lots of hands-on learning. Well, I'll tell you, for me personally, as a student, that is not something that interests me. That is not something that brings up my talents. It's not something that I like even doing as an adult. I never liked it as a kid. And so I think that's important for two notes. There are kids who are like me who, you know, and I'm not saying don't expose kids to this stuff, but don't think that because you liked it as a child, that it's going to work for your kids. But also understanding from my own perspective, because I don't like it, doesn't mean that some of the kids in my class or some of the people I serve wouldn't excel doing it. And I think that's what's really important, is you have to really kind of get in the head and the heart of your kids so you can actually understand what you know brings out the best in them. And when you talked about the notion of professional learning and how important that is, I usually will go to a district or, you know, I'll speak to a large group and I'll do a keynote and, you know, give them some content, give them some ideas. But all of my breakout sessions after I deliver content, they might have a topic, but they're all conversational, and every single one of them goes based on the directions the participants are asking me, not on what I believe the participants should be learning. And there's two reasons I do that. First of all, if it sucks, it's the participants' fault, to be honest with you, because they're leading the direction of their professional learning, right? They came in the room, they're interested in the topic, and I'm basing it based on what they're asking immediately, not even waiting like a few minutes. I'll say like, hey, we're talking about this day. What do you want to know? And people are actually shocked when I do it, because they're like, wow, like, I don't know what to do here because I'm not used to being asked questions this early. But I think the other part of it too is I'm trying to model the importance of actually tailoring stuff to the learners in front of you. And I'm trying to model that. And people will walk out of my sessions and say, like, that is so different from, you know, what I'm used to. And it was really fascinating how you did it. And I think what's really important is that there's kind of this, I'm not an absolutist. Like, I'm not like all kids should be creating all the time. No, I think content's really important, but I also think, you know, creation is really important. But the content is delivered at the beginning, and really what we're trying to do is, you know, kind of riff and, you know, build upon the knowledge that we have so we can all dig deeper, because each one of us has our own experiences, we have our own connections, we won't have our past knowledge, our own curiosity, you know, what really we're excited about. And I think that's what you're trying to tap into with your students in your classroom, is that I hated reading as a child, but the reason I hated reading is because I was forced to read books I had no interest in. But if you knew I was really interested in sports, if you knew that I really loved nonfiction, would that have changed a lot for me in school? And, you know, some of the stuff would be tailored, you know, to my learning. Now, again, not an absolutist. I don't think kids should have 100% of what they're learning based on what they're interested in, because sometimes we have to expose our kids to things in the first place that they might not be interested in, that they can actually, you know, develop a love of, you know, at some point. But I think that a lot of classrooms around the world traditionally have really done nothing but expose kids to content and things that they have no interest in, and makes it harder for them to stay in that whole process. But if you can find that balance, you know, how do we tap into the passions of our kids? The content that I'm not interested in at first, you know, going back to the relationship piece, is actually much more, you know, attainable, much more interesting. It's kind of like, you know, candy with medicine, if that makes sense. Yeah. And like I always talk about, some of my biggest regrets, as an adult, was my parents didn't force me to stick with piano. My parents didn't force me to learn Greek. They let me out of those things too early. And I wish they would have, you know, been strict with me and pushed me a little bit. But just because of the time that I grew up in and the community that we lived, they didn't push it as much. So I think really knowing your learners is so crucial to the work that we do. And I'm not – I understand when I use the term learners, I'm not just talking students, I'm talking all of us. And I think that's something that I'm really passionate about.
Yeah. And I think about, you know, you've made this distinction kind of within that whole theme of the difference between empowerment and engagement. And I think I was really struck by that, because throughout my whole teacher training, there was this real focus on, you know, on sort of creating an engaging, entertaining lesson so that all of your kids were with you. And that onus was really placed on the educator. And I'm interested to hear you talk a little bit more about the difference there and what that empowerment really means. Like, what is that? And how can we harness that to create those meaningful, more passionate learning environments like you were talking about?
Yeah, I think that, you know, I think back when I first started teaching, I remember student teaching, and I remember one teacher basically staying up all night, doing all this work, just preparing all these things, and watching them just totally flop in front of the class, because the kids were like, we're not really interested in this, and they put so much work into it, and it was more about what the teacher did than what the students were doing. And really that importance of building relationships, it is really, you're trying to eventually have the students that they find their own way, that they find their own direction. And like even something as simple as, you know, I don't know if this was mentioned, but I used to be a principal. Mm-hmm. When students were sent to my office for whatever reason, there were two things that I asked them. And I did this every single time. And so the first question I would ask them is, why are you here? And that's it. That's all I would ask them. And the really powerful process of asking them the question of why are you here is sometimes, first of all, they don't know what you know. And so they'll stop and you're like, oh, wow, I had no clue that happened, right? Because you're almost like guessing, like, you know, they know I know something, but they don't know exactly what I know. And so they'll start telling you stuff, right? But the more important part of that is that I wanted the student to take ownership and focus on the process, as opposed to, you know, when I was in school, like, hey, I know you did this, that was wrong, this is this, this is this. And I wasn't sitting there thinking the entire time, like, oh, I have so lost my way, and thank God my principal is redirecting me. All I could think about was how much I hated my principal at that very moment, right? Mm-hmm. And so focus so much on my on them, not on my own action. Mm-hmm. And so eventually, you know, kids would always eventually tell me. And then the second question I would ask is, what would you do if you were me? And kids were always a million times worse than I would have done any of the punishments or any of, you know, the disciplines for what they've done. And why I did that is you're trying to develop these kids to figure out, first of all, maybe not to do that action in the first place, but to take ownership for their own actions. And that also comes back into the classroom, is that, is a kid learning only because I teach them, or can I develop this kid that they will learn on their own, whether I'm in the room, whether I'm in their presence, you know, whether I'm leading them in the place? And I think that's what we're trying to develop in our students. Now, when I make the talk about the notion of engagement versus empowerment, people are like, they always talk about, well, isn't engagement important? I'm like, yeah, engagement is important, but this is the easy way I can explain this, that if you are engaged, it doesn't mean you're empowered, but I guarantee if you're empowered, you are definitely engaged. And so it takes it to a whole other level. And that's what we're trying to focus on. It doesn't mean that, you know, everything we do, kids have 100% ownership. It's all about empowerment, but it's kind of citing that as an end goal, as a, you know, a bigger thing. But some classes, it's you do what I tell you because I've told you, and that's like the whole compliance model. There's sometimes where that's necessary. And, you know, there's sometimes it's necessary in life. I always say that the IRS isn't going to say, like, hey, thanks for sending your taxes in PowerPoint form this year, right? You have to do exactly the way that they ask you to do it. But it's so much easier to do the compliance when students understand there's opportunities for empowerment, where I can sometimes lead the direction that I'm going in to get to the objective, or sometimes I'm actually leading to a path that maybe not necessarily something outlined in the classroom, but it's still valuable as a process. And I think empowerment is so crucial. And one of the things I talk about in the book is the importance of innovating inside the box, that we all work in a box, we have curriculum, we have budgetary constraints. How do you actually create opportunities for empowerment, but still make sure you're doing your job? And I think as a principal, I really wanted to empower my staff to figure out their own ways to do that as well. And so this innovator's mindset concept isn't just, hey, we want our students to have this. It's how we all do our work, and it's how we all, you know, create our own solutions to what we're trying to do.
I love that. I'm so glad that you talked about constraints, actually, because that was one of the things I wanted to talk to you about. We are in this really interesting place right now, especially where I'm at, which is British Columbia, where we've totally overhauled our curriculum. There's a lot that's up in the air, and there are very different sort of, you know, opinions in terms of what assessment looks like, what classroom teaching looks like, what sort of school-wide policies are coming down the pipe. And so within also that current climate of inclusion and what that looks like, coupled with the funding limitations, you know, in many of the public schools, there are tons of sort of school culture limitations in place that can make it really difficult to innovate. But that said, what advice would you give to a teacher or even a principal or educational leader in a district who really wants to create this culture of change and innovation in spite of some of that constraint sort of philosophy, perhaps?
Well, it's actually really interesting. I actually didn't even know you were from BC. I was actually just spoke to all the trustees in BC, I think maybe like 2-3 weeks ago, and talked about these very ideas. And they were very receptive to it. I don't like to brag. They gave me a standing ovation, and I'm only using that as just a kind of a guideline that this wasn't me talking crazy and no one was with it. This is something they see, like, hey, this is where we want our kids to go. Mm-hmm. And the reason I'm bringing that up is because one of the things that I talked about, and it ties directly to digital footprint, one of the trustees actually posted on their Facebook, and oh, it was just getting killed by community members. Like, it was so, so bad. Mm-hmm. And And it was talking about, you know, when kids leave school, they should have like, you know, their own digital portfolio. They should have their own networks. They should have, you know, and there's like things like this. And people are saying, well, what about like social skills? What about this? I'm like, yeah, of course they have these things. It wasn't like, if you just have these things online, don't even worry about having face-to-face conversations, right? And so it was really powerful because I saw the conversations going on online, and a trustee, and I think the trustee was like a little bit like, oh, maybe this guy is nuts. You know, maybe we're going to dishonor our community because look at the feedback. And I actually went through every single negative comment on that Facebook post, and I replied to each person, and every single one of them ended up basically saying, oh, okay, now that makes sense. Or like, oh, I totally agree with that, because I actually, all the things that they were saying were crucial, were also crucial to me too. But they just saw that as long as you have these three things. And the reason I bring this up is because it really reminded me how important it is to bring our communities into this learning so that they have an understanding of it. Because, yeah, you're going to have constraints, you're going to have this, but if you work together with your community, it's going to be much more powerful. And I am a big advocate of not just sharing new learning opportunities, you know, to parents about what you're going to actually, you know, do with their students in classroom. And it's going to be sound like this, you know, guinea pig experiment on their kids and see what happens, but to actually immerse parents into the learning that you do with their kids, like actually bring them in to like have nights and like get them to do some things they're doing. Because the one of the biggest fallacies is that parents want school the way they had it when they were a child. That is not true at all. Parents want what's best for their child, and many parents know no other experience than what they had as a child. And so they believe that's what's best. And what you want is community members coming into those schools, experiencing some of that learning and walking and going, this is so much better than I was a kid. I'm so grateful they have this. And I think that it will start opening doors because, you know, you have like I would love to say that, you know, all of your teachers are totally on board and the parents are pushing back. But, you know, parents, like there's teachers that are against a lot of the stuff that I say because they're very not, I wouldn't say traditionalist, but they have a very distinct way of thinking and nothing's going to change their thought process. But I think that when you start finding those answers together, and then you can start finding your way around the constraints and people start thinking differently about how school can look. Because I know that in BC, just from some of the stuff that I've seen online, I see that people are, I don't think everyone's 100% behind the curriculum, but I also don't think everyone 100% has looked into it. I don't know if that's a fair statement, but.
No, I think you're right. I think there's lots of assumptions, which tends to happen as well. You know, I think with anything that's an unknown, you know, we place sort of our biggest fears upon it, and then that can manifest and become something else altogether. And so, no, I think there is sort of a dichotomy between some of the people who are really have really bought in, and then some people who are still exploring and still trying to figure it out, and a bunch of people sort of in the middle. And so, yeah, I think it's just an interesting time. And I think it reflects the nature of our globalized world, right? I think there's all sorts of uncertainty. And I think in order to get comfortable in it and to elevate ourselves and our strengths so that it actually fits into that world, we sort of have to lean into that discomfort, right?
And I think like a lot of people, because I do talk obviously a lot about technology and the opportunities that this brings us now. And people say, well, what about social skills? And I just say, oh, no, we don't teach social skills anymore. We don't teach it face-to-face. We have 100% don't want our kids talking to each other. We want it all digital. And then they start realizing how ridiculous their statement was, that of course we're teaching social skills, but we also have to kind of understand, like, and one of the things that, you know, when I mentioned talking about that trustee posting, I think one of the things that was really interesting is that we talk about how nasty our kids are online and how they cyberbully, and some of the comments were not nice about me, and not realizing the person who presented the content has a family, you know, he's trying to do what's best for his own daughter. And it's almost like we don't use, you know, those spaces as much to have conversations. It's almost, it's a good way to dehumanize people. And so when you see adults doing that, and then they wonder why we teach our kids to be kind online and, you know, to challenge, but not, but to always be thoughtful. I think that it shows how important that time is. And of course we teach all these skills, but I always talk about in, like when I work with large groups, I'll say, you know, I'll say who went to school here in the 60s. And, you know, a few hands will go up, and then 70s, a little bit more, 80s more, 90s more. And then I'll say, I guarantee that the time of your school day was about this amount of time. And every single person, it's pretty much the exact same time, no matter when you went to school, but the demand on teachers has gone up and what we're expected to teach. And so what we really try to, and this is why it's so important to get your community, we have to really have some conversations like, is this really as necessary as it once was? You know, is this as crucial as it once was, or is this something that we need to talk about? Or, you know, maybe we should, maybe when we were kids, you know, when I was in school in the 80s and early 90s, maybe we should have talked more about financial literacy and how important that was. But I didn't know any of that stuff. And I got in so much, you know, trouble with, you know, credit ratings and stuff like that, because I didn't learn any of that stuff in school. And why was that not taught? And I think these are conversations that are so crucial with our community, you know, if we're going to move forward. But we can't just have this either or scenario, like we're going to teach social skills, but no online stuff. Or, yes. You know, and like it's not an either or dichotomy. It's kind of finding. And I think that's, and going back to what you talked about earlier, that's our relationship piece is so important, because one community can look vastly different from the other community. And that's why we have to build relationships. You can't just go, I can't be successful in one school in one area and then just bring all those ideas to another school in a totally different area, a totally different community, and they'll just all work. You have to build relationships with people that you serve.
I think that's so important. And I guess it brings me back to this whole idea, really, of the innovator's mindset. And you know, that you're actually living that in many respects, right? And so this idea of kind of going beyond Carol Dweck's model or paradigm of the growth versus fixed mindset, but you actually have this third column you've posted online a number of times and in your book as well about the innovator's mindset and how it kind of fits into, it actually goes beyond that paradigm. And I think you're kind of living it in many ways, but would you take us through just a little bit about sort of how it fits into that model?
Yeah, so when we looked at, Carol Dweck's work is something that I've, you know, been really interested in and, you know, paid attention to, and really kind of growth mindset, just summarizing. And obviously, like, I don't want to do disservice to Carol Dweck's work. Really, you know, teaching kids that they have the ability to learn in different areas. Now, I think one of the things that's really important is understanding that, because this drives me crazy, I see people being labeled with, oh, if you don't agree with me, you have a fixed mindset. Like, that's not how it works, right? So, for example, I always say, like, I have a very fixed mindset towards skydiving. I don't care that I can learn it. I have no interest in doing it, and I don't want to go through that process, right? And so that's okay to have a fixed mindset in some areas. Like, I'm not against it. I don't think it should be used against people. But I do believe that when we talk about growth mindset, it is putting a nice spin on compliance. So if you say to a kid, like, you need to believe that you can learn this content that you actually have no interest in the first place, it's still compliance, right? And I think what we're trying to teach people is kind of going that next level, is that yes, they have the ability to learn, but just sitting on knowledge is not necessarily helping you or the world move forward. It's actually what you do with that knowledge, which is so crucial. And that's where we took it to that next level. And it's not saying the growth mindset is like, it's a versus, like, it's either the growth or the innovator's mindset. The growth mindset is crucial to the innovator's mindset, but I just think it takes it to that extra step. And, you know, I've been challenged on it quite a bit, and rightfully so, as I should. But if you can tell me where a situation where someone took their knowledge and created something better because of their knowledge is a bad thing, I'd be open to listening. But I don't see that as a negative skill that Because I don't ever pretend that, hey, if you get kids to develop this mindset, here's the increase in marks that you'll see right away. I'm more focused on our kids having abilities to create their own pathway. It's been proven over and over again that grades do not directly correlate to success in any aspect of life. But teaching kids these skills to actually, you know, create something with their knowledge, I can't see where that is going to be seen as a massive negative to the future of our children.
Yeah, and I think at the sort of the crux of this is this idea of creativity. And that's something that has really, I think I've connected with personally a little bit more myself, is this idea of, yes, it's great to know things, and yes, it's great to be learning and having that the ongoing conversations. But I think when you really delve into something and then recreate it in your own, using the passions and strengths that you have, it's kind of like a magical transformation of your learning, right? And I mean, you talk about this piano analogy too, which I think is so great. I just think that's such a great illustration.
Yeah, and the piano analogy is like, compare the three mindsets. Fixed mindset is the belief that I can never learn to play piano. Growth mindset is, you know, I believe that, you know, with time and effort, I can actually learn this. But the innovator's mindset is, I will not only learn this, but I will compose, I will create music. And that's what we're trying to actually, you know, take our learners and develop in ourselves. And one of the things I do often in professional learning, because I do work a lot with adults, and it does throw people off, I'll do something with like a Google Doc or a Google Form, and I will actually walk into a session talking about some of these things, but I actually have nothing ever prepared, like nothing. And I will create a form on the spot, get information, you know, what the participant questions are. And I will go through creating that form as fast as possibly as I possibly can. And I will stop and say, hey, look, if I was too fast for you, learn faster. And I say that to people, and people are like, oh, how dare you not show us every single step? And what I tell them is that I'm not here to show you step by step. I'm here to show you value. Because if I can show you value, you'll go figure it out yourself. But if I show you step by step but show you no value, you'll have no interest in doing anything with this after. And so I'll directly tie, like, hey, if you could do what I just did, here's how you could use it in an elementary class. Here's how you can use it in middle class. Here's how you can use it in high school. Here's how you can use it with admin. And then people's light bulbs start turning on. And the one thing I always say is that, you know, using like a Google Doc or Google Form, that's not innovative. It's how you use it, which is the innovation. But I do need to know how to use it and create these things. But once I start having that content, once I start having that knowledge, then I can start really creating something really cool that I couldn't do without it. And the analogy that I always use, because like I said earlier, content is something that I believe is really important still. It's not an either or scenario. But if you know your content really well, it's like a jazz musician who has ability to improv. The only reason they have the ability to improv is because they have their knowledge down on how to play their instrument so well, but they can riff and do different things because they have that knowledge. And that's what we're trying to go way beyond just, I can play the music right in front of me, but I can actually create new music. I can actually create new opportunities because I know my music so well.
Mm-hmm. I think that's a great analogy. And again, it comes back to that creating from the content and from the tools that you have. And I think you've mentioned that quite a few times in terms of how you approach tech, that it's not actually just about, it's not about just exposing kids to tech and these tools. It's really about the why behind it and what is the purpose behind the use of the tool, which I think is so profound. Being mindful of your time, I want to just touch quickly and sort of change gears for one more question before the rapid fire. I want to just briefly touch on this idea that leadership is not about controlling people. It's kind of about unleashing their talent. And you've said that. And that really it comes from this deep sense of trust. So when you think about it from a principal standpoint, or even that for that matter, from a classroom teacher standpoint, or pardon me, a school teacher standpoint, what are some of the ways that you can ensure that you're building this high trust environment over that compliance oriented one?
Well, one of the leaders that I worked with, her name's Kelly Wilkins. Easily, she was the best leader I've ever had. Just, it was like she was just working on a different level. Like I would all of a sudden, you talk about, you know, how client compliance is important. She could just get me to do things that I'm like, how am I doing this? And like with a smile on my face the whole time. she's just incredible. Right. And the reason why is because she really gave me ownership over things in the school as a teacher. And I remember I was in charge of technology in the school. I was like an ed tech facilitator, right? It was not an admin position. It was like a kind of like a, it was still a teaching position, but you worked with other teachers. And I remember her coming to me and saying, hey, like we have the budget and I want to know what you think we should buy with our technology budget this year. I'm like, oh no, that's your decision. And I remember saying to me, George, we hired you because your expertise. I don't understand this stuff. Hmm. That's why we hired you. And so even though I'm a classroom teacher at the time, you know, I'm working with, or, you know, I should say school teacher, right? I don't want to be corrected on my own stuff, but, I was really thrown off because I actually was never given that ownership, even though that was a role that I'd done in several schools, because that was usually what the principal's decision or, you know, and someone did that. And I'll tell you, I put so much thought into what was going to go into other people's classrooms because I knew they would complain about it if I screwed up. And so I had much more ownership within that school. And I think that I tried as a principal, you know, we had professional learning, we had certain goals, and my staff would not only lead the professional learning, design the professional learning days. And I'm not talking about a few staff. Every single staff member had to choose one of the objectives to lead the professional learning. They also created the objectives on how we were measured success because now they're their objectives and they're much more, they have much more ownership over the direction. And that's one of the things that I think is really crucial is that if I say to you, hey, you're going to lead it, but I'm going to measure you on what I believe is the correct measure, then it's not really giving them the power because you can, a lot of times people pretend they give you ownership, but they really just want you, they just want to delegate. But at the end of the day, they want the credit. And really, I wanted just to give over the building because, you know, if we struggled in one of those areas, it's now the ownership of that team. Mm-hmm. And so now it becomes much more important that we actually do really great stuff in those specific areas. And it was all the other aspect of it, I think, was really important to me is I despise when people say you can't be a prophet in your own land. I'm like, why not? Like, why are we not having within our own schools that we look across the hallway and see that person as an expert? Why are we not seeing, you know, people within our own schools who, and I'm sure you've seen this before, who are being revered by people all over the world, but people in their own school have no interest. And yes. There's something really wrong with this, right? And so I wanted people to start looking at each other as the expert, that if I could develop them that way when I left, then you knew the expert was literally like you were teaching beside them, then they would be fine without me. And that was always my focus.
That is such an interesting topic, which I feel like I could talk about forever because, yeah, I have noticed that. And I think it's almost like you have to receive that sort of like the gold seal of approval from the outside before people on the inside will accept and see it in the same way.
I think almost when you receive the gold seal from outside, some people will actually try to discredit you within your own building, which is.
Oh, yeah.
And I've seen that, and it's really unfortunate that, you know, we should be celebrating one another. And the one thing that I always say, and this is not just like me pandering to a crowd, is I will always say to the group that I'm working with, when I'm keynoting, the expert is not standing in front of you. The expert is sitting beside you. We need to learn from each other. We need to tap into this community because this is such an amazing time. We connect with people over the world, but if you cannot connect with your own school, it doesn't matter. And so I don't teach anymore. I'm not in the classroom every single day. how dare I deem myself the expert of teaching when this person literally I'm looking at and is sitting beside you is doing this stuff all day. Those are the experts. Those are the people we need to start tapping into, not someone who, you know, did a bunch of case studies and, you know, hasn't taught in a classroom for years and tells you, yeah, this is what you should do based on me not actually being in a classroom. I really struggle with that. I'm not saying research isn't important, because I know if someone got that out there, I'm not saying it's important, but I do believe that great teachers are researching every single day based on their experiences. It's not, they might not be quantifying every single thing they're doing, but I'll tell you, there's so much we can learn from each other's, you know, expertise and experience.
Yeah, I totally agree. I think that's so important. Before we jump to the really quick rapid fire questions, is there anything you'd like to add before we move on?
I think for me, one of the things that I appreciate and I try my best to do, and I know there's a lot of new initiatives, a lot of people are really pushing themselves, but one of the things I really focus on is really my own mental health and being very thoughtful of my time. And I'm sure this is not easy for me to get on the podcast, because I am very thoughtful. I used to be able to, you know, be proud that I could work like 14, 16, 18 hour days. And I don't necessarily think that's a good thing anymore. Mm-hmm. And I struggle with that. And I think that just don't try to do everything. Don't try to be everything to all people. You have to take care of yourself before you can really help others. And it's something I've really, really tried to focus on. So I know some people might listen and say, oh, I want to try this, I want to try this, I want to try this, but just make sure that you always keep your own mental health and well-being, you know, in the forefront to really help others.
Thank you for that message. I think more than ever, we need to hear that all the time, right? Thank you. So in just a few words or less, what does kindness mean to you?
Just bringing brightness to the day of others. My goal, honestly, is that I'm the best interaction for every person I encounter in a day. That's my goal every day. Hmm.
What one skill or superpower does a teacher need to lead with in order to be effective?
Relationships. David Pesek, one of my favorite principals ever, said, you can know your curriculum inside out, and if you can't build relationships, you will not last as long as someone who's really great with relationships and doesn't know their curriculum. Hmm.
And finally, if you could print a quote or a saying on one of those quote cups sold in bookstores around the world, what would it say?
The one quote that I share all the time is that change is an opportunity to do something amazing, that we're so terrified of change, but when we actually take advantage of it and lead the initiative, that's when I think that's when change becomes positive. But if change is thrust upon us and we're not ready, I think that's when change can become negative.
Amazing. George, I really want to thank you for joining me today and for making the time. I know how important it is to sort of earmark that time for your family and for the work that you do. So I really am very deeply appreciative that you spent an hour with me today.
My pleasure. All the best to you and everyone in BC.
I want to thank you for the wonderful reviews that you've left for this podcast on iTunes. Your reviews make a big difference in helping other educators find this show. If you think that I'm doing good work here and you'd like others to get inspired and join our 21-day kindness challenge and movement, I'd love it if you would take a minute, head over to iTunes, and leave a review. Thank you so much. This has been another episode of Kindsight 101, the podcast. For links to resources mentioned in this episode, visit smallactbigimpact.com and click on our podcast and choose this episode number. Now, I'd love to give my audience a heads up about my new book, which will provide ideas, actionable strategies, and inquiry-based approaches to creating kinder classroom through serving the community. Subscribe to my blog for more information. Now, I would love to hear from you. What's the biggest insight that you gained from this conversation? Head over to our website, smallactbigimpact.com, leave a comment on our podcast page, or tag and connect with us on social media with the hashtag #SmallActBigImpact to share your inspiring story of kindness. Can't wait to hear from you.